Welcome to the Theosophia Podcast, a platform for women's voices in theology, curated by Sarah Elizabeth Smith and the Reverend Sarah Dendy Green. Follow us on all of the social medias and visit our webpage, theosophiapodcast.com, to stay up to date on what Sarah and I are up to. We put out one episode a month that features either a different voice or our own voices talking about a theological topic. This week's podcast features a very inspiring lay leader in my community of Oklahoma City, Ann Ali, or as some folks in her community call her, the Rev, Ann Ali. I've gotten to know Ann through my time in the Episcopal Church ministries in Oklahoma and have always admired her strong voice and wisdom she brings to any space she's in. Ann is one of the most faithful and caring humans I have ever met. In this episode, Ann and I chat about her life and service to her community and country as a police officer, an Army reservist, a pastor, and a teacher. We also get into her thoughts on what God is calling us to during this time of coronavirus. Ann is full of cultural and familial wisdom anecdotes and speaks of a faith that moves mountains and restores weary souls to their Maker. Ann is an agent of change and seeks to share the love of God to all those she meets, especially those on the margins she works with in homeless outreach as an Episcopal lay leader in her home church of St. Augustine's, Oklahoma City. I hope y'all enjoy listening her story as much as I did. Here is the Rev. Ann Ali. Okay, so Ann, do you like going by like the Reverend? Like when
in the African American community, I'm still pretty well much addressed as Reverend, and in some other situations as well. But mm-hmm. being that I'm no longer in the Methodist Church and I'm in the Episcopal Church, mm-hmm. and at some point we'll be seeking orders, we just have to go by protocol. So I've kind of gotten used to just being called by my middle name, which is Ann,
Right. So Ann, take me back, because I definitely want to get to your work in the church in the Methodist Church, but what is your spiritual and religious background? Like, how'd you grow up? What was your kind of childhood experience with faith?
Okay, I was born to older parents. And I spent time in the Baptist Church and the Methodist Church as a child. And I went to Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. So I had a little bit of everything. While at Catholic schools, we were required to take religion courses, which we did. And I always enjoyed doing that. I always felt that I had a calling on my life. Mm. There was no option for not going to church in my home. It was mandatory. My mother was very active in our church. And even though she was in a Baptist background, she was lovingly referred to as a preacher as well, because she spoke all of the time. And one of the few women who were actually allowed to preach or speak from the pulpit in an African-American Baptist church.
Wow.
And, looking back on that now, I think maybe they were more afraid of her, afraid to say no. But anyway, she never, there's a tradition in some of those churches, some of those Baptist churches where they don't want women in the pulpit, and they want, if there's an occasion where they may have to speak, they put them at a lectern or something. But, just growing up, I never recall my mother being at the lectern. And I always remember her walking in with the pastors and preachers when she was called and put in the position to do so. And she sat in the pulpit. There you have it. As I said, I was born to older parents. My father owned a gas station in the community for many, many years.
Where did you grow up, Ann? Sorry to
interrupt. East Oklahoma City, which I still live in our family home.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
So where'd you go to high school?
I went to Northeast High School.
Okay.
Graduated from Northeast High School. I spent a year at Millwood High School, and a lot of my friends from the Catholic school had gone to Northeast. So after a lot of whining and crying, my dad finally relented and let me go to Northeast so I could be with my friends. And at that time, Northeast High School had the biomedical program. So it was a pretty good school at the time. Had a great time. But like I said, I went to Catholic schools. What I didn't know or understand at the time going up as a kid was that my mother was ill, okay? And maybe as a child that I wasn't supposed to know that. She had a very bad heart condition. And as I've gotten older, I have learned that she was told that she probably would not live to see me become an adult. So one day when I was 13 years old, my dad came and picked me up from school and said, your mom's in the hospital. And then 2 weeks later, my mom was dead. So my dad was 72 years old. And so he was a former Oklahoma City police officer and he owned his own gas station. And we lived very comfortably. My mother worked civil service and did a lot of things in the community. She was really a Rosie the Riveter. She spent time on the West Coast during World War II and, you know, just did a lot of fabulous things out there. But lost her suddenly, but, you know, we were able to go on. And believe it or not, my mother prepared me for that. I didn't realize that, but and for me to say that she prepared me, she taught me a lot about God and about life. Okay. When she did pass, I knew pretty much what my purpose was and the things that I had to do to be successful. My father was more of a disciplinarian, having been a police officer, no nonsense kind of guy, you know? So I really didn't have much of a choice. I had to be a good kid. You know, they got their bluff in early. Graduated from high school, 1985, Northeast. National Honor Society member, top part of my class. Went to the University of Oklahoma. Stayed there a year and a half. And my dad started getting ill, okay? Remember, I mentioned to you that my dad was 72 years old when my mother died when I was 13. So my dad started getting ill, and I moved back home, started going to OCU, and my father's health really started to decline. I started getting afraid and started thinking about what I needed to do, okay? Because it was looking like, okay, I need to get a job in order to support myself. So, a semester away from graduating from OCU, I was hired on the Oklahoma City Police Department, okay? And went through the Police Academy, class number 101, became an Oklahoma City police officer. I was an officer for several years before my father passed away. But during that time, I was working full-time and also taking care of him. After my dad passed away, I went back to school and got a degree in criminal justice from Langston University and went on to graduate school. So I have advanced level graduate work in education and in business administration.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So still being a police officer, had a pretty good job. You know, it was nice, had good times and bad times. Saw a lot of things that I probably wish I could forget. Ended up going into the military, into the reserves, joined the Army National Guard, Army Reserves, was assigned to the 95th Division. Spent some time there. And after a while, I had an opportunity that presented itself in the Air National Guard. And I ended up going from the Army Reserve to the Oklahoma Air National Guard, the 137th Security Police Squadron. And I spent several years there. So I served honorably in both the Army Reserve and the Oklahoma Air National Guard while working as a police officer with the Oklahoma City Police Department.
Wow. You are a busy woman.
I've been busy. Well, you know, my parents kept me busy growing up because in their minds, the idle mind was a devil's workshop. So it was a good thing to, you know, just keep the kids busy. So one thing I didn't tell you was that one day, I do have a sibling. I have a brother. We're 19 years apart.
Wow.
And I kid you not, he came home from college for Christmas break. And he found out that mom and dad had too much time on their hands and that he had a little sister on the way. So, that's how that happened. And like I said, we're 19 years apart. He lives here in Bethany.
So. Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, going back to your days in law enforcement, was that, where did that like sense of call come from? Was it kind of out of necessity to take care of yourself and you knew that worked because of your father, or what drew you to, you know, law enforcement type work?
Well, you know, as a kid, I grew up watching Adam 12 and the FBI, and, you know, I always had a fascination with law enforcement. And also looking at the stories and that my dad told and his friends. And so the curiosity was always there. And, you know, I just ended up in the field, you know, just kind of happened that way. Over time there, I felt a tugging at my heart for a call into ministry. And let me backtrack a little bit. While serving at the Catholic school that I attended, I would always serve at Mass on Fridays. So I had a leadership role there. And in our religion classes, I was always a standout student, you know, as far as discussions were concerned. So I always had a deep interest in religion and theology. So, you know, I knew at some point that I may end up going into ministry. I just didn't really know how and when. And then as we get older and we start living and enjoying life, you know, we just, you know, sometimes we just live our lives and do some things that maybe we probably shouldn't have done, you know, but that's part of living a full life.
That's right.
But I can say I've lived a full life. I've had my fun. And I thank God that he didn't call me home while I was out having my fun and allowed me to get back under his compassionate arms of grace and mercy. And I finally took heed of my call. I used to go around to different churches singing, okay? And I would participate in concerts throughout Oklahoma, Texas, and Arkansas. I was friends with a concert promoter. And what he would do is he would have certain acts to open shows for the artists that he would bring to town. Some of them were quartet artists like the Jackson Southerners, or just gospel singers like Grammy Award winning singer Shirley Caesar. I've opened for her several times and in several places. So I started meeting different friends, you know, just who were doing ministry in different ways, whether they were singing or preaching or, you know, whatever. Over time, I just decided to get serious about my call. And I found that when I did, I had more of a peaceful life. And here I am. I served in the Methodist Church as a pastor for a little over 4 years. And while serving at a church in Ardmore, Oklahoma, I came into contact with a deacon by the name of Joyce Spurgeon, Deacon Spurgeon. You may have heard of her.
Oh, yeah.
And at the time I met Deacon Spurgeon, I was the pastor of the Metropolitan AME Church in Ardmore. And we would have different outreach events for the community. And my goal while serving as pastor there was to unite the city of Ardmore religiously, okay? We needed to start seeing beyond the walls of what side of the track that we were on. I would invite different religious groups over, and we would just have events. And it really started to pick up. And that's how I met Deacon Spurgeon. She came over to an event that we had after the incident in Charleston, South Carolina, at Emmanuel.
Right, right.
Okay, we had a program. And people came over and we just had a program and we mourned those who were lost. And we pledged to come together as Christians, despite our backgrounds. And then we had that program and we had another program where we had what we called a preach-a-thon, which was an all-day type of church thing. And we didn't want to go all night, but we went from like 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And each hour, a different church would come and present. So you didn't have to stay, but each church would come and present, whether it was musically, spoken word, or preaching. And we did that. And my God, we did that on a Saturday, the first time we did it. And after the event, when I returned to the church the next morning to preach, as I arrived, there was a mist that covered the grounds and a surge of energy that just made the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And I knew that was the Holy Spirit. You know, it was just so powerful. Mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of like I say, you could compare it to Jesus resurrecting Lazarus from the dead, you know, bringing the spirit and vitality alive in that community. On the same vein, after meeting Joyce Spurgeon, our church, at the time, decided to form a partnership and join them on the fourth Sunday of each month with a homeless outreach project that they had going on. Now, let me backtrack just a little bit. At the church that I pastored at, Metropolitan, we had a community clothing closet, okay, and a pantry. And we would serve the community in that fashion. People could come in and get clothes and whatnot. And we also had a pot that we had collected for those in need. And if there was a need, we would do our best to try to help that person resolve that need financially. You know, maybe there was a bill that needed to be paid. For several years, I think for 2 years, we had a substance abuse program at the church where people who were struggling with alcohol and drug use could come. And basically, those who were involved in those communities in Ardmore would come. And you know, it was amazing. I got a call one evening from our church mother, and she said, "Pastor, there are like 40 cars at the church." And for a small church, you know, the size of ours with about 25 members, you know, that was something. And, you know, there was a need, you know, within the community, because just right outside the doors on any given day, you could see someone under the influence of alcohol stumbling down the street, you know, who needed something to eat, who needed, you know, some help, you know, counseling or whatnot. So we were able to do some positive things in the community. We didn't have much financially, you know, but we used what we could in a great way.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so your relationship with Deacon Joyce, is that what eventually led you to joining an Episcopal church in the city?
You know, over time, I would go every fourth Sunday and we would serve the homeless. And you know, I never thought that there were that many people in need. And let me say, not just the homeless, but people who were hungry in Ardmore, because most of the time we would serve anywhere from 90 to 100, 110 people. And it just wasn't any type of service. They actually had a real dining experience with silverware, okay, and real plates, fine china, and tablecloths, you know. So, and we were the actual waiters and waitresses. We actually served them. So having done that probably about 6 or 7 months, and we did it, you know, for about 2 years. After about 6 or 7 months, someone approached me, and someone in ministry who was in the Episcopal church. I don't know who he was, and I think maybe he was retired, but he was just there helping, you know. And he approached me. He said, "Have you ever considered, or would you consider, the Episcopal church?" And I said, "You know, I really hadn't thought about it, but you know, I'm gonna file that away." you know, and you know, my mate, because I didn't know where God was really leading me. And let me say this. I found that as I tried to bring the communities of color together, that didn't always go over too well, you know? And that's just a reflection, unfortunately, of the society that we live in, you know? You still have a lot of people with biases. And then I started to see that I was being used as an agent of change, a change agent, which is not always an easy thing. People don't necessarily want to change.
Prophets are rarely listened to in their own home, right?
There you go. Exactly. So I started to get a little pushback, but I felt true to my calling. So I was beginning to have some doubts as to whether or not my future was going to remain in the AME church. I don't want to say anything negative about a certain denomination, because we're all God's children. But I actually think, having been called and realizing now that I am a change agent, that in order for me to stay true to my calling, that I probably would have to leave that nest, okay? I didn't know where I would go. And over time, things began to get uncomfortable for me there. And let me say this, I'm reminded of an old sermon that the Reverend C.L. Franklin, who's an African-American minister, very well-known, deceased minister, he has a famous sermon that was titled "The Eagle Stirs the Nest." And basically the story was about how the eagle prepares a beautiful nest for her eaglets. And as they begin to grow, she brings roughage into the nest, things that make the nest uncomfortable, in a way to get the eaglets to not spend so much time in the nest and begin to learn to fly. And having said all of that, one day I realized that it was time for me to leave the nest of the AME church. And not that I had done anything wrong, not that I was in any trouble. I could have stayed, but I just knew that my assignment there was over with. So I called Deacon Spurgeon after I resigned. And that Sunday, I think it was September 7th, 2016. I think. Anyway, I gave her a call just to tell her that I had resigned, and I appreciate, you know, her befriending me, and let's stay in touch. And she's like, "Well, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go?" I said, "You know, I really don't know, but I think I will just start visiting St. Paul in Oklahoma City, because it's on the way to work. I drive by it every day because I work at St. Anthony." And I said, "I think I'll just start visiting St. Paul for, you know, for a little bit." And she's like, "You know, let me make a call. And there's a church on the far north side of Oklahoma City called St. Augustine, you know, and I would like for you to meet the priest. He's doing some phenomenal things there." And I said, "Okay, you know," and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm saying this to myself. Okay, that's fine and good and great, but I'm still going to go by St. Paul, because what you don't know, Deacon Spurgeon, is I have a car with 300,000 miles on it, and I need to try to save that thing. I'm not going to drive far north Oklahoma City every Sunday, you know."
But you hadn't met Father Joe yet.
No, I hadn't met Father Joe. Long story short, I ended up meeting Father Joe, okay? And he's like, "Well, you know, when can you start?" And I'm like, "Huh?" And I'm like, "Okay, I'll be here." So I ended up driving my Suburban, who I lovingly call Bubba, that has 329,000 miles on it, started driving it to St. Augustine. And
now, just to interject real quick, I just want people to know that Father Joe is like this like short little black man that
yes
has more spunk and energy, and like he, I call him like the king of liturgical art. Like the man knows liturgy and loves liturgy more than anyone I've ever met, and he's just a fantastic homilist. He has more energy than like three of me, and he's a wonderful mentor to me. And he's, I can't say enough about Father Joe, but anyways, please continue about your car.
Great mentor. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go, you know, I'm starting going to St. Augustine now. And, you know, I meet Father Joe, he takes me to dinner and we're talking and whatnot. And I'm like, look, man, I've been pastoring for 4 years. I've been driving 110 miles one way every Sunday and throughout the week to the church that I pastored in Ardmore, America. Okay. Now that I'm not pastoring, I just want to sit down. I want to hug a pew. Come in late, you know? Miss a Sunday every now and
just
then.
Just chill.
I'm gonna chill. But you know, Father Joe would not let that happen.
Hell no. He put you to work.
Yeah, you know. So I ended up going to work at the church. I really got involved in the homeless outreach program that we have because I feel that my calling is to work with the homeless and with those who are suffering from substance abuse or have mental health related issues. I've always felt that way. You know, sometimes God lets you know what your calling is. And rather than to be like Jonah and end up in the belly of the whale because I didn't go to Nineveh, I decided I'd better go to this particular church because of, you know, one of the things that it had to offer. And that was our homeless outreach that really, you know, that really got my attention. So I work with Deacon Robbie and a few other people there. And we really have a great program doing what we do and helping those who are in need. So,
yeah, St. Augustine's is a really special church in our diocese. And it is one of our only multicultural churches. Yes, yeah.
It is. So. And back to being a change agent. When I went to Catholic schools, we had nuns. And I spent some time at Villa Teresa. And most of the time in Catholic school, my time was spent at Corpus Christi. 8 years. I learned as a child to work with people of other races. And having been exposed to that, as I got older and my eyes began to open, I just noticed that really wasn't a popular thing. And then I was reading where Dr. King, you know, had said that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in our nation. And it still is.
That's right.
And, you know, just having gone through some things, having served in the military and worked with different people of different races, having served on police department and several rural police departments in addition to Oklahoma City, and having worked with people of all races and backgrounds, you know, you learn to realize that we're all the same. And, you know, one of the things I frequently ask people when I'm prompted is, you know, in heaven, we're going to have to learn to live together anyway. We're going to be living together, you know? There's not going to be a barrio in heaven. There's not going to be an African-American section. There's not going to be a reservation. It's just going to be heaven.
Right.
So let's work on doing that now, okay? Mm. Because that's God only sees souls. He doesn't see color. He sees souls. Mm-hmm. And if we can ever learn that, you know, that would be something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm an agent of change. I'm a change agent. That's what I am pursuing, is bringing our races together as one and helping people to realize that, hey, we are one. We are one in Christ. You know, we're the same. You know, it doesn't matter what socioeconomic level you're from. Now, let's go into what we're dealing with today, the pandemic. Personally, and these are my own beliefs, I think that God is using this pandemic in several ways. Number one, he wants us to realize that he is still in control, okay?
Mm.
Number two, he's using it to cleanse and fix the earth environmentally. Okay?
Yes, yes.
And I'm sure you've seen, you know, on several news reports where different things across the globe are healing now. Okay, you've got the situation in Italy, okay, where the waters are becoming more pure. The ozone layer is healing itself, okay? So, you know, there are some things that we as humankind have done, you know, unfortunately, that have hurt our earth, and it needs to heal. So the earth is healing. That's two. Three, he's letting us see the evil in the world. And by that, I mean what our problems are. A, we have a problem with equity in our society, okay? We have to learn to become equal. We have to learn to become concerned about our fellow man, okay? We've got financial issues that separate us and biases that have developed and have been allowed to fester to where we're putting people in classes, okay? We look at people, you know, from a class-wise situation. The immigrant situation, just my God, it's just horrible. The inequities between Black and white, the inequities between poor and rich. You know, so there are a lot of things that we need to look at. And I think he's using that to get our attention, you know, because he's still in charge.
That's right.
We just need to learn to listen to him, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good thing and a bad thing. And lastly, I think he's using it to call his people home.
Mm.
You know, to call his people home.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me with all this is just how the common good, the notion of the common good, which I'm thinking in a very spiritual sense, like Catholic social teaching, like the common good is a value of Catholic morality. And I'd say Anglican Episcopal morality. We have the baptismal covenant that says we need to honor the dignity and respect the dignity of every human being, right?
Every human being.
That's right.
The race, class, gender, whatever.
But that's hitting up,
you know, whatever.
That's right.
Yeah, and we're not there. We're not there. You know, we're all human. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah.
And that's hitting up against our American individualism. I need my rights and my freedom. Like it's those two things are like clashing really hard right now. Yeah. Oh, it's difficult.
And it, unfortunately, you know, and I can say this because I'm not a pastor, you know, so I'm a little, you know, it's from the top down. You've got someone in the highest executive office of our land that's feeding this, you know.
Yeah.
That's feeding it and allowing it to fester.
Right.
And it's got to stop.
Yeah.
So.
What about this? You mentioned you want to talk a little bit about, too, like, mental illness and awareness of those things during this time too.
Prime example myself. Having been a first responder, having served in the military, I saw a lot of things and I went through a lot of things that were not very nice.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things that I had to learn to deal with. And when my mother passed away years ago, counseling was something that was not really accepted. And we're talking about early 80s and prior to that, okay? I probably went through some things that I really didn't have to go through if I had received counseling at an early age, okay? So over time, I have learned, and having gone through and continuing to go through counseling, because personally, I think everyone should have a therapist. I have no shame, you know, in my game. Everyone needs someone to talk to, especially.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, going to a counselor and seeking help from a counselor or a therapist is a good thing. We've got to get rid of the stigma. Now that we are in a pandemic, and most of us have been confined to our homes, all of us have gone through some sort of anxiety, some sort of depression. You know, our routines have been changed. Things are happening financially, you know. Things may be happening job-wise. We're concerned about our jobs. We may have lost a job, you know, or our job roles may have changed, you know. So we need to learn how to balance that and how to deal with that. And you deal through with that positively through mental health care services, okay? So I think that we should all reach out to providers, you know, if we can. And there are even some services that are available for free, but we need to get away from the stigma of doing that. The other thing is, and working in a hospital, some of the nurses, I have a running joke. And let me go into a little bit more detail. I don't just work in a hospital. I work in the psychiatric unit of a hospital. So on bad days, sometimes we'll laughingly say, you know, I had a rough day, but I'm a key holder. I still have keys. I can go home. I don't have to stay.
Right, right. The point
that I'm trying to make here is that all of us are just walking a thin line between being psychiatrically sound and unsound, especially in times like this, you know. So we should, you know, not be afraid to reach out for help or assistance because it's available. Also, and let me go on to the homeless part. We're all just one step away from being homeless, whether we want to admit it or not. You know what I'm saying? So when you deal with that type of population, and having dealt with that type of population as a cop, you know, when I deal with them, I look at them as my fellow man because they are my brother and sister who are going through some unfortunate times. Some of the stories that I have heard over the years were just unreal. And let me tell you a story. I remember, probably in 1989, 1990, I got a call to a truck stop in far northeast Oklahoma City. I think it was Wilshire and I-35. And there was a call about a subject that was there. And I came into contact with that guy. And that guy was from back east. He has a master's degree. But he was just down on his luck. And for whatever reason, he was involved in an incident, you know, at a truck stop. And, you know, the call that I get referred to him as you know, a homeless person being there, you know, causing a ruckus. I don't remember all of the details, but I just remember the conversation that I had with the guy. You know, that guy could have been you or me. You know, he was educated. At one time, he had a job, but he was just going through a difficult time. You know, so we need to be, you know, available. We need to make ourselves available to mentor those type of people because it could be us or someone that we know. And we need to try to provide services, okay, for people who are in those situations so that they can get back on their feet and get back to a life of normalcy.
Right, right. So do you see like this call or these types of things you're passionate about, like directly related to the work of the church? Cause I feel like you are a pastor and a priest in your work every day. You are. That is your ministry and taking care of kids in the hospital and caring about the homeless. I mean, those are all ministries.
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. And I look at them that way too, because, yeah. You know, when I received a call about the job to get the position that I have, you know, and I remember going to the interview, and I told them, I said, hey, you know, this is a ministry, you know, because it is. And I've often referred to it as that, you know, dealing with people of certain classes, you know, who are confined like that, you know, yes, it takes a special type of person. It's a special calling, you know. Because at the end of the day, the kids in that situation, at the end of the day, the homeless and those who may be going through substance abuse, all they want is for someone to love them, okay? Someone to show some concern, okay? Someone to help them remember that they are somebody, you know, despite what they may be going through or have gone through, you know?
How do you think the church can facilitate helping these types of folks?
Well, you know, as far as the church as a whole, I think the Episcopal Church is doing a wonderful job with all of the ministries that it has and the outreaches that it has, just to keep doing what they're doing, you know, just going out into the communities and loving people and showing them the love that we're supposed to show as Christians. So yeah, we're doing that. And here's the other thing. The pandemic has also taught us that the church does not lie within walls. You know, for decades.
Let's talk about that. Yeah.
For decades, I attended a church or churches where, you know, people would get all dressed up and, you know, put on a nice hat and high heel shoes or whatever. And, you know, then they just go sit inside a building. Well, I don't think that's what Christ intended the church to be. We, as individuals, are the church, and we are to go out into the community and show that love to our fellow man. You know, there's an old spiritual that says, if I can help somebody along the way, that's what we're supposed to do. Help one another. And I'm going to tell you another story. I was coming home from church one night, and I was driving Bubba, which is my old, I've got another vehicle, but I was driving Bubba, which is my old Suburban with 330,000 miles on it. And I got to a corner in Northeast Oklahoma City, and it was on a dimly lit street. And there was a guy sitting on the corner with the sign. And, you know, you see people with signs all of the time. And I looked over at him. He was kind of scruffy looking, black guy with a beard. And I heard the Spirit say, help him. Pull over and help him. And I'm like, really, God? You know, that's the kind of relationship I have. We talk like that. Lord, I'm tired. I'm not going to pull over and I might get mugged. This guy might try to mug me and I had to pull out my pistol and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, and so because I have that background, I think God also puts me in different situations. So I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to, but I went ahead and pulled over. And I started talking to the guy. And I reached in my pocket, and I normally don't give money to people I see on corners. I may give them food or something like that. I reached in my pocket. I didn't have a whole bunch of money, but I gave him what I had, and he called me by my name as I was handing him the money. Now, mind you, I didn't recognize this guy at all. He called me by my name. He told me what school I had gone to. He told me that he had gone to school with me, and I looked at him. Now, mind you, I didn't recognize him. He was a homeless guy with a scruffy beard. And then finally, after looking at him for a while, I called him by his name. This is a guy that had been in my house, the house that I'm in right now, okay, had been in my house as several times. His grandfather was an electrician. So I knew he had skills because he was in my house, working in my house, making repairs with his grandfather. But just like I said, you know, earlier, we're all just one step away from uncertainty, okay? And here he was, someone that I knew, someone that went to Catholic schools, okay? Someone that, you know, Catholic schools usually aren't free, you know? So he had opportunities just like I had. But here he was, you know, in an unfortunate circumstance that could have been you or I, but that was him. So I was able to help him and minister to him. And one of the most profound things that he told me was, I don't want my mother to see me like this. Okay. So we have to learn to be compassionate.
Yeah.
Come to find out, he ended up having a drug problem. Okay. This man had learned a trade and was licensed in his trade. Okay. And it was a very, very good trade where he could make money at. But he found himself by the wayside. Okay. It happened to him. It could happen to you or I. And now that I've gotten you here, let me take you a little bit further. I grew up without a want in the world. My parents were very well established, okay? They left me a foundation to stand on. I didn't know what it was like to be hungry and have the lights turned out because I couldn't pay the bills or forgot to pay the bill until I became an adult, okay? So all of my life, I had a pretty blessed life until one day I lost my job. And I went from making a whole lot of money to not making any money. But during that whole period of time, God always made a way for me. And, you know, I want to remind people that we truly serve a God of restoration, because God allowed me to go from not having anything to having the palace once again, okay? Just like God restored Job, just like God allowed Satan to take Job through a trial, the same thing happened to me. So if we continue to believe on God's words and stand on his promises, I just want to remind everyone that they are true, because it happened to me. If you see me out sometime, ask me about it. I'll gladly tell you what happened, but it's real. You can count on God's word and his promises. He brought me from the pit back to the palace.
Mm.
So, and I'm thankful, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a couple stories like that myself. So I'm with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I was wanting to ask you, what are some of your favorite spiritual practices to help you through, especially right now, the pandemic? What are things that help center you or bring you some peace during anxious or tough times?
I talk to God all of the time. You know, I live alone, so if someone was probably here with me, they'd probably be like, oh man, who, geez. I talk out loud to God, but my prayer life has been what has gotten me through. Ever since December of 2010, I get up every morning between 4 and 5 and I pray. And I'm reminded, I think the scripture is Mark 1 and 35, which talks about Jesus got up before sunrise, and I'm paraphrasing. Jesus got up before sunrise and went to a solitary place and he prayed. So my belief has been, if Jesus could do that every morning, then so can I. And once I started doing that, I found myself in more peace. I found myself being blessed. I found my spiritual growth increased, you know. The other thing, and I didn't know you were going to ask that question, but I have this I keep in Bubba, my Suburban, and then this one that I keep in my new vehicle that I have.
Are these like bobbleheads?
These are bobbleheads of Jesus. Okay, so when I'm driving down the road and I have a little mischievous thought or something, you know, or I'm thinking about doing something bad or something like that, I just look over and it keeps me back on track, you know. So that's what I do. But anyway, I don't know why I pulled these out, but something said pull them out. You might need it. Oh, and also, I learned a long time ago why I remain a sinner if you could be a saint. So I am a New Orleans Saints fan.
I was wondering where that came in. You're always wearing New Orleans Saints stuff. I was like, did she grow up there? Or
no, I didn't. Actually, I had a cousin who played on their inaugural team from Oklahoma City. His name is Jimmy Hart, H-A-R-T, and he was on their inaugural team. So we have the fleur-de-lis. And I just like to say one for the Father, one for the Son, one for the Holy Spirit. So any football team that was organized on All Saints Day, hey, you know, come on.
That's pretty awesome. I love that.
So these are reminders, you know, for me.
Yeah, that's great. And don't you play some music? Aren't you a musician of sorts?
I grew up trying to play music, but my dad, you know, was more concerned about me getting an education, so he kind of clamped down on some of that, so I have a musical background. I could play at a few instruments. I play enough to get by, and actually the real story with that was that when I had the church in Ardmore, we didn't have a musician, and I didn't bother to tell the membership that I had a musical background, because I just knew I wasn't going to be playing anything again. And one Sunday, probably about after 9-10 months there, one Sunday after church, I was walking back to the pastor's study, and I walked by the piano and I just felt myself drawn to it. Seriously, drawn. And so I grabbed a hymnal and I hadn't played in about 25 years. I grabbed a hymnal and I said, I wonder if I could still do this. So I opened the hymnal up and I started playing, you know, playing it a hymn. And the piano sat next to a window, a stained glass window. And all of a sudden I heard a tap on the window. And I'm like, okay, I wonder who this is. Well, our church mother lived a block from the house and she had been trying to call me on the phone. And my phone was in the pastor's study. And she had walked around to the back door of the church and no answer. So she came to the window. Now, I had been sitting there playing the piano for a little bit of time. So when I went to the back door, she walked into the sanctuary. She said, Pastor, are you in here by yourself? And I said, yes, ma'am. And then she said, And I mean, what do you mean, Now, this woman was 90 years old.
Calling you out.
So she said, Pastor, was that you playing the piano? And I'm like, oh, you got me. You got me. She said, you mean all this time we haven't had a musician? And you can play the piano. I said, no, I really don't play the piano. And I kind of told her the story, you know. And she's like, well, you're going to start playing the piano next Sunday. So, and that's how I kind of get back into the instruments again.
So, that's awesome. That's awesome.
There you have it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, anything else you want to add about this apocalyptic time we're in?
You know, and I'm going to be honest with you. When everything started happening, I saw the handwriting on the wall because they sent us home from school, you know, with the message not to return until further notice. So as we were preparing to go, I kind of told a few of my coworkers, hey, go gas your car up, go by the store, you know, stock up, because I kind of, you know, seeing the handwriting on the wall. And like I was telling Father Joe, it really kind of set me back a minute because, naturally, having been a first responder, I'm preparing for the worst. And I told him, I said, you know, if I had a house on the property that I have in Eastern Oklahoma, I would have gone down there and I'd be there right now, away from everyone. So the first thing was a flight. You know, for me, it would have been flight. Now we're in the fight mode, okay? And that's why it's important for everyone to understand that you're not alone if you're having these feelings, you know, because I just wanted to run and get away from everyone. You know, I literally sat in my room and refused to come out for a couple of days. And I knew I wasn't alone, you know. So it has taken me a while to get to the point to where I can really, you know, roll with the punches. And so now I'm in fight mode. Okay, so we have to fight this thing. Where's my mask? We have to fight this thing. So we need to listen to the scientists and what they tell us to do. Here's my mask. I'm also a Cubs fan. Okay.
She got a Cubs mask.
Right, yes. I have a lot of faith in my life because the Cubs was a losing team for hundreds of years. Okay, they maybe even had a curse on them, it's been said, okay? 1907 and 1908, they won back-to-back World Series. Mm-hmm. And it would be another 108 years to be exact, before they would win another one. Okay, so the point that I'm making is here's a team who kept on going, just like the New Orleans Saints, okay? Who are also known as the New Orleans Aints. Because for so long, they ain't have won a game, okay? So the point I'm trying to make is be faithful, keep going, never give up. Mm-hmm. Okay, but back to our conversation about the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We need to listen to the scientists, in my opinion, okay? Mm-hmm. And we need to take heed and use the proper precautions. Mm-hmm. Wear a mask when you're going outside. Wash your hands, keep your hands off your face, you know? And just be careful because mm-hmm. we're in this for the long haul. It takes a while to develop a cure.
Yeah.
Or a vaccine, you know.
Right, right.
And it's not going to be an overnight type of thing.
Right.
For whatever reason, do not put disinfectant into your body for whatever reason. Please don't. That's poison.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bad thing. Bad you do. But anyway.
Well, this has been really, really awesome, Anne. And I'm so thankful you took the time. And I really hope you do, you know, jump into holy orders process at some point in the Episcopal Church. I think I was like, we need you. We need a change agent.
No,
I'm going to keep coming back. That's what I'm going to call this episode, Reverend Anne, the change agent.
Well, thank you. You know, I going into ministry in the Methodist Church is a time process, a timely process. It takes time. I'm going in. I just didn't want to be a Jonah, okay? Because when I came into the church, God told me some things that I needed to do before I announced my orders. And that's what I'm doing. So I'm coming to a close on that time frame, and we'll go from there. But definitely.
Awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. And okay. So thankful for all your ministries that you're doing right now.
Thank you.
So you're a wonderful presence in our city and in our diocese. So I'm so thankful to know you.
Thank you.